Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first hour of Focus, we'll be talking about taxes and tax policy. Over, roughly speaking, the last 25 years, tax issues have dominated economic policymaking in the United States. In terms of dollar magnitude, the most significant laws enacted during every presidency since Ronald Reagan have been tax bills. The tax system is perhaps the one aspect of government that directly affects more people than any other. Certainly, it may well be the one that draws the most complaints. It can be clearly very confusing. In this hour of the show, we will be talking about taxes and taking a look at who pays them, how the tax system is structured, and certainly open things up to questions. And we have two guests this morning, both of them economists, who are known for writing about taxes in a way that makes it understandable to people who are not politicians or policy makers or certified public accountants. Our guests are Joel Slemrod and John Bakia. Joel Slemrod is the Paul W. McCracken Collegiate Professor of Business Administration and also Professor of Economics and also Director of Tax Policy Research at the University of Michigan. And John Bakia is a Professor of Economics at Williams College, and that's in Williamstown, Massachusetts. And together, they are the authors of a book that has now it's been out for a while, and they're now publishing the third edition of the book, so it has been updated a couple of times. A book that should be very helpful to anybody who is interested in getting a better understanding of the tax system we have on the federal level. And the title of the book is Taxing Ourselves, A Citizen's Guide to the Debate Over Taxes. It's published by the MIT Press. It is out in paperback, and it is certainly available out in the bookstores and the library if you would like to look at it. Also, as we talk here, questions are welcome, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana and toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Slemrod, hello.
Hello.
Yes, and Professor Bakia.
Hi, pleased to be here.
I hope I'm getting your name right here.
Yeah, you got that right.
Okay. We try if we can to get people's names right.
Yeah.
Thank you both very much for being with us. We certainly appreciate it. And I like very much the quote that you give here at the very beginning of the preface. Now, whether he said it or not, it makes a good story that apparently it is said that Albert Einstein once said, "The hardest thing in the world to understand is the income tax." So it's comforting to know that even Albert Einstein found it confusing, and obviously most everybody does. Let me begin with a big question, one that you devote an entire chapter to here. So I'm not sure if it's something that we can truly talk about in brief, but I'll give you the chance to do that. And that has to do with fairness of the system. And it is one of those things that I'm sure that I believe that people like to complain about most, at least to the extent that many people feel that they are paying too much and that there are other people, particularly wealthy people, who don't pay enough. So it sort of depends upon who it is you are, whose ox is being gored here. Is it actually possible to say something in a general way about the issue of fairness, and to what extent complaints about somebody paying too much are justified?
Well, it's a good place to start because I think a lot of people do think about fairness when they think about tax policy. Unfortunately, it's not a good place to start for two economists like John and I because fairness is not really an economics issue. Two different people might have very different conceptions of what it means that taxes are distributed fairly among the population. And in our book, we certainly quote both politicians and ordinary citizens about what they think is fair, and you get very, very different views. Some people think it's fair that everyone should pay the same amount of tax. Some people think it's fair that people should pay the same proportion of their income in tax. Some people think that rich people should pay a much higher proportion of their income in tax than low-income people, and then low-income people should pay nothing at all, or maybe even get something back like we do now in the earned income tax credit. So it is fairness is not entirely an economics question, or even most importantly, an economics question. Mm. It's a question about values, but it's a question that is central to tax policy debates.
Well, maybe another way to ask the question is, let's say if we look at the top 10%, maybe, or maybe even the top 1 or 2% of earners in this country, or maybe even we set aside the word earning. We just look at where the wealth is, the people that have most of the wealth. How much do they pay in taxes?
Well, David, we should probably figure out a way so that we know whether you're directing the question
toward John or myself.
I think we're both waiting for each other to speak.
Oh, I see. I'm sure probably either of you could answer that question. John, you want to take a shot?
Yeah, well, why don't I address that question? I mean, if you look at the top 1% of the U.S. income distribution in recent years, they earn about 18% of our nation's income. So they get a disproportionately large amount of income. And then they also pay a disproportionately large amount of taxes. They pay about 36% of federal taxes. And all federal taxes combined take up somewhere around 30% of their income, depending on how you measure their income. What this points out is that our federal tax system is progressive. And what I mean by progressive is that high-income people pay a larger percentage of their incomes in tax than lower-income people. And the main reason it's progressive is because of our income tax. And I think an interesting thing we bring out in our book is that most people don't believe that. If you look at polls, most people say a couple of things. They say large majorities say they think the rich should pay more in taxes. But large majorities also tend to say that they believe that the middle class pays a higher percentage of their incomes in taxes than upper-income people. So they believe that the rich are not paying much when, in fact, the income tax is taking a fair amount of money from rich people. So what that suggests is most people seem to like the idea of a progressive tax system and having the rich pay a larger share of their incomes. They don't believe we have that. And when, in fact, I think we do.
Well, perhaps another question we could ask would be something like this. Let's say if you take a look at how much tax people in this income range pay and what has happened to that over time, we can go all the way back to when the income tax as we know it came into being, which was around 1913, something like that.
Yeah, 1913.
So look at over those years at the taxes that the wealthiest people have paid, and you chart that out. What does it look like?
The very striking change has happened over the last 10 or 20 years. The fraction of income taxes paid by the richest 1% have gone up quite dramatically, and a lot of people who support lower tax rates for high-income people point to this statistic and say, look, the richest 1% are paying a higher and higher fraction of all the taxes. This is true, but the major reason for that is that the richest 1% of people over the last 10 or 20 years have been getting a higher and higher fraction of all the country's income. So the fact that taxes have become more concentrated among high-income people is mostly a reflection that income is getting more and more concentrated among high-income people, this measure of income inequality has been getting larger and larger over the last 10 or 20 years. So if, as most people believe, taxes should be related to the income one earns, it makes perfect sense that as income has gotten more concentrated, so have taxes.
Yeah, and just to amplify that point, I mean, if you want to put some numbers on it, the top 1% of income earners in the United States, in 1979, they got about 9% of the nation's income, and today they get around 18%. So their share of the national pie is almost doubled. It's also true that, while the share of total taxes that are paid by this top 1% has gone up quite a bit, the percentage of their incomes that they pay has gone down a bit. relative to 1979. It went down quite a bit in the early 80s and came back up with Clinton tax increases. And now, compared to 1979, the top 1% is paying just a couple percent of its income less in taxes than it was back in those days.
Perhaps we could shift and talk a little bit about the people who are in the middle, because this is, again, one of the complaints that we have often heard, or at least I'm sure we've heard this over the last 10, 15 years or more, and that is that people in the middle-class people, are bearing an increasing burden. That is, they're being increasingly squeezed, and they're having to pay more tax. And again, I'm sure that their complaints are directed at more wealthy people that they think are not paying their fair share. That may or may not be true. But let's talk about what's happened to people who are sort of in the middle range.
Yeah, well, factually, it's not true that middle-class tax burdens relative to income have been going up. It's been remarkably stable. So if you look at people in the middle fifth of the income distribution, taxes as a share of their income has been almost completely flat from 1979 to today. It's a little bit below, it's between 15 and 20%. And it's really been very flat, sort of in that middle of that range. So there hasn't been a big change at all in the share of incomes going to tax for the middle class. There has been a change in complexity of tax for these people, though, in particular because of the alternative minimum tax, which is a sort of parallel tax system that was developed in the late 60s in an attempt to prevent high-income taxpayers from escaping tax altogether, but it's now sort of creeping down to affect the middle class. And the effect this has is that people have to go through and figure out their whole tax bill, and then they have to go and do it all over again and pay the larger of the two taxes. That's the effect the alternative minimum tax has. And this is going to be increasingly affecting the middle class as we go forward into the future, partly because it's not indexed for inflation, so more and more people start to have to pay it.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you say, we have this thing, the alternative minimum tax, that was put in there as an attempt to get at more wealthy people, higher income people who were not paying enough taxes, or somebody thought weren't paying enough taxes. And so it wasn't really designed to hit these people in the middle ranges, but it is. Now, and I think that also in Washington, there are a lot of people who think that it ought to be, I don't know whether they ought to get rid of it completely, or it ought to be changed so that it does more of what it was intended to do. What do you think is the likelihood that the alternative minimum tax will be fundamentally changed?
There's certainly a lot of people in Washington and throughout the country that think of this as too complicated and think of it as unnecessary in our tax law. The problem now is that it's become very, very expensive to get rid of it. It raises a lot of money. So you'll find very few people who say, yeah, we really like the idea of having these two parallel tax systems the way we have it and all the complexity it adds. It's been difficult to get rid of because we're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars of tax revenue. The President Bush had a tax panel convened in 2005 to try to come up with proposals for fundamental tax reform. And the first thing they agreed on unanimously was to get rid of the alternative minimum tax. And in the report they eventually produced last November, it was abolished. The alternative minimum tax was there, but that suggestion so far has not picked up any political momentum. So I think we're stuck with it for the time being.
Yeah, I actually worked as a staffer for that tax reform panel, and that was a huge issue. I mean, it's an issue that not many taxpayers are aware of yet because most people still don't face this alternative minimum tax. But as Joel said, it's very expensive to get rid of this thing. All our projections of future revenues sort of assume that eventually a huge portion of the population is going to pay this tax, and it costs over $1 trillion over 10 years to get rid of this. And much of what this tax reform panel had to do was driven by this consideration. They wanted to get rid of the alternative minimum tax, but to pay for it, they had to do all sorts of very unpopular things, like getting rid of all sorts of popular deductions and so forth. And it just made the job of this panel very difficult.
Let's then go take another step and talk a little bit about the taxes paid by people who have the lowest incomes. And I think that there have been efforts to try to ease the tax burden on people who are low income, and probably the biggest thing would be the earned income tax credit. What do the lowest income people pay in taxes?
Go ahead, John.
Okay. Well, it's true that the tax system has gotten a little bit more progressive at the low end in recent years. President Clinton greatly expanded this earned income tax credit, which is a very popular program, even on both sides of the aisle, partly because this is a way of helping low-income people that actually encourages work. So, for example, if you have two children and your income is below about $13,000, for every dollar you earn from your job, you get a tax credit, which is basically like a, you know, you get a tax refund of 40 cents for every dollar you earn from your job. And then at higher income levels, this is phased out. So this was increased a lot during the Clinton years. In the Bush tax cuts, they greatly expanded child tax credit. So right now you can get a $1,000 tax refund for every child that you have. And this is not so helpful to people at the very low end of the income distribution, the very poorest people, because it's not refundable. In other words, if you don't owe any tax, then you don't get any money back from this child tax credit, although you can actually get a little bit if you have some labor income. But for sort of moderate income people, this is a huge help. And these two things combined have really helped bring the average tax rate on people in the lowest fifth of the income distribution down from about 10% back in the early 80s down to around 5%.
We have a caller. I think it would be good to bring them into the conversation, see what sort of questions they have. And, of course, other people who are listening are welcome to call with their questions. I should also introduce again our guests. John McKea, he is Associate Professor of Economics at Williams College. That's in Williamstown, Massachusetts. And Joel Slemrod is Professor of Business Administration, Economics, and also Director of Tax Policy Research at the University of Michigan. They are the co-authors of the book Taxing Ourselves, A Citizen's Guide to the Debate Over Taxes. It's now out in its third edition. It's available in paperback, published by the MIT Press. And if you're interested in trying to get a better understanding of the federal tax system that we have, and also some of the proposals that have been made to change it, that is a book that you could take a look at. And questions here, welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a caller in Champaign to talk with on line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I know very little about tax other than I hate to pay mine, but I do. And the complexity requires me to hire an accountant, and therefore my transaction costs go up every year. And I don't like that. And that's a part of my fairness equation. I'm asking you, therefore, would it be fair? And I know economists don't speak in terms of fairness or equity. You speak in terms of efficiency. But would a flat tax at the federal level, similar to the flat tax I believe Illinois has at the state level, be a better way and a fairer way and a more progressive way for the federal government to go? And I'll hang up and listen to your response.
All right.
Okay, can I take that one?
Because
that is it's a terrific question, and it raises a lot of the central issues about tax policy. First of all, the caller is not in a minority. Now over 60% of all individuals pay somebody, a professional, to help them with their taxes. And that in itself is an indicator of how complex the tax system has become. We can actually put a dollar figure on the costs that, in both the time and the money that taxpayers put into their tax affairs. And it comes to over $100 billion a year. That's the money they pay preparers and accountants, and a value of the time they put in. And that's a big number, and if that isn't buying us anything, if the complexity isn't buying us anything, we should certainly make the system simpler and reduce the hassle and money people have to pay, which brings us to the caller's suggestion about a flat tax. We actually spend a lot of time in our book talking about a flat tax and what a flat tax means. It means at least two different things. And one is flat, meaning the rate that is a flat rate, the same tax rate applied to all income. That in itself won't make the tax system much simpler. If we kept our current system exactly the same and just changed the rate structure so that we have one rate, I think that would just be a very, very modest simplification. And after all, the complexity is figuring out what your taxable income is. Once you do that, it's pretty easy to figure out how much tax you owe. It's aspect two of a flat tax and flat tax proposals that's really critical, and that is simplifying the process of figuring out what your taxable income is. Right now, it can be very complicated. It isn't for everyone, but it can be very complicated because of the rules describing what is income and what isn't, because of all the credits and deductions and exemptions that are available. That aspect of flatness, cleanness of the tax base, or simplicity, a lot of progress could be made. There are proposals out there that would vastly simplify the tax process, would mean that a lot less people have to go to tax preparers, and these costs of complying with the tax system could be a lot lower. So I'm all for thinking about the second, but it's really important when these flat tax proposals come up to keep in mind these two different things, a flat rate and a flatter, clean or simple base.
So that, I think this is really, not to put too fine a point on this, but I think this is a really important point that you make, particularly for those people whose complaint, and I know there are a lot of people who do have the complaint, that it's just too complicated. And that is, if that's what you're concerned about, having everybody pay the same rate, that may be one way to do it, but that's not the only way to do it. And by doing other things, you could make it easier without and still maintain some kind of progressivity if that's important to you.
Yeah, I'm not even sure that's one way to do it. I mean, I think just changing the rate structure really contributes very, very little to making the tax process simpler.
So cleaning up the base, you would say if you're really concerned about simplification, you actually have to do that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree. I'd like to address one other question the caller had, which was if we switch to a flat tax rate, would the system be more progressive? And I think the answer is no. If you took the existing tax system and just changed from our current progressive rate structure, where the top rate goes all the way up to 35%, and replace it with a single rate that raises the same revenue for everybody, the rich would pay a lot less and everybody else would pay a little bit more. Now, you could partly mitigate that if you also cleaned up the base, because most of the deductions and loopholes and things like that benefit high-income people. But even so, if you went to a really clean base and got rid of a lot of these deductions, and move to a single flat rate, you'd still end up reducing taxes on the really high-income people by quite a bit, and everybody else would have to pay a little bit more.
Real quick here, I want to get in a question, and then I have the call. In fact, the lines are full, so I want to get right back to callers. But that is regards one thing that affects a relatively small number of people, but it's something that has just been up for discussion, and I'm sure it's not going to go away, and that is the estate tax. The Congress some years ago did pass a measure that would phase out the estate tax gradually over time. The thing is, though, the phase out has a sunset, so they would phase it out and then it suddenly would be back again. So some members of Congress, Republicans particularly, would like to get rid of the estate tax. There was an attempt to do this in the Senate yesterday, which was not successful, but I expect that they'll try again. Just to ask a basic question about the estate tax, who pays it? How many people pay it? And if we abolish the estate tax, how much revenue would the government end up losing?
Yeah, the estate tax is another fascinating aspect of the tax system for a lot of the reasons we've already talked about. First of all, so it's payable on net worth at death by the estate. The exemption for the estate tax is so high that only about the richest 2% of decedents' estates owe any tax. So this is by far the most progressive aspect of our tax system. 98% of people pay nothing, and about 2% pay something. It raises about 1 or 2% of all federal revenue, so it's not a major part of our revenue-raising system, but it is, as I said, the most progressive aspect of the tax system. So you're right that there are a lot of people who want to get rid of it. The law as of now is sort of bizarre in that it's phased out, but still there in 2009. And then for 1 year, 2010, as the law stands now, the estate tax is abolished, and it comes back in 2011. So I doubt it will stay this way, but as of now, we have this bizarre situation that for 1 year, there is no estate tax, and for all years up to and after that year 2010, there is an estate tax.
All right, well, let's talk with some other folks here. Savoy is our next caller, line two. Hello.
Hello. I actually have three questions. I'll ask them in order of importance to me, so if you want to pick what you want, that's how I'd like it. First question, in talks of economics and taxes, people use the terms low income, middle income, upper income, rich. And in my mind, I've never really decided where are the boundaries for those groupings. I mean, from my point of view, I consider what some people consider upper income as really more middle income. And really am surprised that somebody with a family of four could live on $13,000 a year, to tell you the truth. My second question has to do with the alternative minimum taxes. Why, if they don't really want to get rid of it, can they just not get an index, have it indexed to inflation so that it actually goes up? And my third question, you know what, I think I've forgotten it now after listening to everything, so I'll let you go.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call.
John, you want to take number one?
Yeah. So the first question is, like, so how do you define high income? So
yeah. Or any, you know, who's in the middle, who's in the bottom, who's in the top? I mean,
yeah.
How do you decide where the cutoffs are? Yeah.
Right. So just to give you some numbers here, to be in the top 5% of the national income distribution, you need a household income of a little over $150,000. And to be in the top 1%, if you're a family of four to qualify for that, you'd need over $500,000 of income. Okay, so to me, you know, so just to put some numbers on this, that makes it a little more concrete. The sort of median income household family of four in the U.S. has an income around $60,000, I believe. So just, you know, just to make it more concrete, those are some numbers.
Okay. What about the question about the alternative minimum tax?
Yeah, that the caller's suggestion is certainly reasonable. One of the reasons it sort of snuck up on the taxpaying population is that back 25 years ago, we started to index the income tax brackets for inflation, meaning so that when prices went up and there was inflation, people wouldn't automatically get kicked into higher and higher brackets. For some reason, which I don't know the origin of this, the same was not done for the alternative minimum tax. So the exemption levels, when it starts to kick in, stay at the same dollar level year after year. So as prices have gone up, as there's been inflation, that exemption level is really lower and lower, and more people are subject to it. Yeah, we could now just index the exemption level for the alternative minimum tax, and that would prevent sort of a bracket creep into the alternative minimum tax, although we would still have to deal with the fact that at the current exemption level, quite a few middle-class and upper-income people are subject to it.
Yeah, and I should say it's also not quite as – it's not so simple as to just index it for inflation for a couple of reasons. One is that as I said, there, you know, these are two parallel tax systems. You have to figure out your regular tax bill and then the alternative minimum tax bill and figure out which one's bigger. And the alternative minimum tax has a big exemption level. Like for a couple, it's $58,000. The one tricky thing is that this exemption of $58,000 is just temporary. And under the sort of default law that you know, every year it's supposed to revert to this, and every year they pass an extension of the exemption. Under the sort of default law, the exemption is supposed to decrease back to $45,000, and all our revenue estimates, you know, essentially assume that it's going to this exemption is going to shrink again. So you know, keeping that exemption at $58,000 and then indexing it for inflation would help, but that by itself would be very expensive relative to our current budget projection. So even that costs a lot of money, and you got to pay for it somehow. Another issue is that the reason so many people are going to be on the AMT is not just, you know, failing to index for inflation, but it also has a lot to do with the Bush tax cuts. As I said, you figure out these two taxes and pay the larger of them. Well, when we cut the tax rates for the regular tax, that pushed a lot of people's regular tax bills below their AMT bill. And that's a big reason why so many people are going to be on this tax. So that's another reason why just indexing doesn't completely fix the problem.
Okay, let's talk next with someone in Champaign. This would be line number one. Hello.
Yeah, in terms of this, earlier you'd mentioned how the wealth in that top 1% from 9%, you know, the nation's wealth went from 9% to 18%. What happened to the one in the 5%?
Well, let's see. I got the book right here. I don't think I have the data on the top 5%. I should say it's not wealth, but income.
So income, okay. But income. What happened for the middle class? Because there's always a complaint there that, you know, wages have not kept pace.
You know, yeah, well, that's right. So let me just give you some numbers here. I mean, essentially what we're talking about here is so for the top 1% between 1979 and 2000, which was the latest data we had in the book, it went from 9% to 18% of the income going to the top 1%.
Mm-hmm.
The share of income going to the middle 20% went down from 16% to 14%.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty similar across the board for everybody except the top, say, 20%. Like the top 20% went from up from 46% to 55%. Of national income. As far as income growth, between 79 and 2000, for the top 1%, their real incomes after adjusting for inflation grew by 184%. So they're almost three times as large as they were back in 1979. For somebody in the middle income quintile or middle fifth of the income distribution, incomes only increased by 13%. Over the last couple decades in real terms after adjusting for inflation. So there's been some growth, but much slower than at the top.
The other one is that, and that all these issues that come out, in terms of investment, certainly the people up in that higher bracket, I don't know, there's all kinds of things in terms of now, if you invest it later on, not pay taxes at all, and you know, if you pay, there was, I don't know what that procedure was, something about that, they had an opportunity to pay their taxes, and then they wouldn't pay later on at all when they take out, you know, the money. What does this mean for generating taxes later on for people who are retired? I mean, not retired, but that are retired, and in terms of the nation?
Well, there are a couple interesting policy issues you raise. First of all, it is true that the income tax system has lots of special provisions that are designed to increase the rate of return to savings and make savings more attractive. There were the traditional IRAs where you got a deduction for money put into an account and then you paid tax when you took it out. I think the caller might be referring to the new Roth IRAs where you put money in this account and you don't pay any tax ever on the return to the investment, although you don't get the deduction up front. And there are special tax provisions for saving through employer pension plans, too. So although we nominally have an income tax, there's a lot of provisions in the tax code that exempt income from savings in order to encourage savings. Some of these provisions do have implications for future tax revenues. The new Roth IRAs will certainly reduce tax revenues in the future compared to the traditional IRAs when you had to pay tax on your withdrawals. And now when people are being encouraged to shift from the traditional IRA to the Roth IRA, there are tax payments now when you do that and less tax in the future. So yes, it's tricky, and a lot of the tax policy changes one might contemplate not only have implications for revenues today, but revenues for 10, 20 years down the road. And that's important because anybody who's sort of looked at what the federal budget situation is a decade and two decades out know that things just don't add up. If we pay out the promises we've made in Social Security and Medicare and combine and compare that to the revenues a tax system like the one we have now will yield, they just don't add up, and they don't add up in a big way. We've made promises that are trillions of dollars greater than the revenues we look to be collecting given the tax system as it is now.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's continue. And our next caller is also in Champaign. This is line three. Hello.
Yes, thank you. The question I want to get to is an issue of the flat tax again, but I want to preface all it just by saying that for a long time, my feeling has been that, you know, the what I'll refer to as the uber-rich don't pay nearly their fair share of taxes, and that even though I think, you know, maybe their tax rate really ought to be more than it is, especially with all the tax cuts they've gotten, you know, even so, I mean, people who have, you know, many tens of millions and especially hundreds and millions and then, of course, the billionaires, which there are more and more of them in this country all the time, you know, I mean, there's all kinds of ways they can shelter their money so they never become subject to tax. And I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. But what my question actually gets to the more personal situation in terms of, you know, not really being sure how, you know, some flat tax would shake itself out. And, you know, maybe, you know, it's not what I'm thinking, but my situation, you know, is maybe different than the average taxpayer, although there's an increasing number of people in my situation. I'm self-employed. I have, you know, a small business I'm running. Now, I'm filing, you know, Schedule C and all these things, and, you know, I have business expenses which are deductible, a lot of them, you know. And if I weren't able to deduct that, you know, my actual, you know, cash flow that I have left to live on would be significantly impaired. I mean, sure, you know, you have an amount of money coming in, but in reality, you don't have it at the end of the day because, you know, there are all these expenses you have to, you know, incur that then, you know, now I can deduct, you know. But so how would that be affected by a flat tax, or would it not be affected at all?
Yeah, I think you can rest easy on that one. There are a lot of different flat tax proposals out there, but the ones that I know of for small business person like yourself, the tax would still be on net income, meaning that it's on your receipts minus your legitimate business expenses. So you'd still be able to deduct that. So you're okay. But the kinds of deductions that most flat tax proposals either get rid of or cut back on are things like the mortgage interest deduction, the preferential treatment of health care, child credits, education credits, that sort of thing. And so most people would have to sort of make a calculation if they're interested in how it would affect their bottom line about the cost to them of losing some of those deductions or having them cut back against the benefits of a lower rate. But as I said, I don't know of any proposal that goes to taxing business people on their gross income rather than their income net of expenses.
Okay. Yeah. I guess, you know, I'm still, you know, I can't make up my mind how I feel about flat tax, but I really do believe, you know, that we need to find a way for people of, you know, extreme wealth to, you know, bear a bigger share, what I would think a more fair share of the tax burden than what they're doing now. But thank you.
So, well, if I could just address that last point, like the last really good study we have of how much taxes people are paying was done by the Treasury Department in 2000, and we've had some updates by the Congressional Budget Office as well. But back in 2000, this was before the Bush tax cuts, admittedly, the top 1% of the income distribution was paying on average 29% of all their income in taxes. So it's true there are a lot of loopholes and ways of hiding income and so forth. But in this really carefully done study, even taking all that into account, they were paying almost 30% of their income in taxes. For the middle fifth of the income distribution, people were paying a little more than 17% of their income in taxes. So it's 30% versus 17%, essentially. So the point is that the current federal tax system is progressive. The rich are paying more. Now, it may be they should pay even more than that. But switching to a flat rate would achieve the opposite of that. Switching to a flat rate would simply involve the highest income people paying less. And like I said, we could make up for some of that by cleaning up the base a little bit, but the single rate is going to mean the rich pay less.
All right, let's go to another caller here. But maybe first I should just introduce again the guests for this hour of Focus 580. We're talking with John Bacchia. He is Associate Professor of Economics at Williams College, and that is in Williamstown, Massachusetts. Also joining us is Joel Slemrod. He is a Professor of Business Administration, Economics, and also Director of Tax Policy Research at the University of Michigan. They are the co-authors of the book Taxing Ourselves, A Citizen's Guide to the Debate Over Taxes. It's now in the third edition, published in paperback by the MIT Press, and has a lot of basic information that tries to answer the kinds of questions that we've been posing here this morning and that callers have. So if you're interested in reading about taxes and trying to perhaps evaluate some of the proposals that have been made to change the system that we have now, this would be a helpful book. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have someone in Effingham next, line 4. Hello.
Okay, yeah. How about a national sales tax? I mean, that could be progressive sort of like, too, because you can non-tax food items and medicine like people really need. But like a luxury item, like a luxury car, a little bit higher percentage sales tax. And like regular car or something like that, just a sales tax but not as high. Have they ever thought anything like that? Because then you wouldn't even have to worry about it at the end of the year, the regular person, because his taxes would be paid as he bought his merchandise.
Yeah. Well, that certainly is one of the things that has been proposed as a possible change, moving away from taxing wages to taxing something else. And it is something that you address in the book. I don't know which whatever you would like to respond to the call.
Joel, you start.
Okay. Sure. This is a proposal for a national retail sales tax has been around. It's familiar to most Americans because 45 of our 50 states have a sales tax, but the states that have sales tax have it in rates of 4, 5, or 6% usually. And the first thing we need to realize is that if we were going to replace our income taxes with a national retail sales tax, we're talking about a rate of tax that's 30%, maybe 35%. So how everybody thinks about the impact of a sales tax, suddenly you got to multiply it by 7. And most economists, not all, but most economists think that it would be very, very difficult to administer in a fair and cost-effective way. Here's one problem. Now, the retail sales tax is supposed to be only a tax on final consumers, so a sale from a business to another business isn't subject to tax. So what does a business do? It has a certificate of exemption that it produces when it buys something so that the sales tax isn't levied. Well, when the rate is 35%, you can maybe imagine the incentive for people to manufacture these exemption certificates when they don't really qualify. And you can maybe imagine the incentive in a business like grocery stores where the gross margin is 1 or 2%, the incredible incentive for vegetable and fruit stores to spring up where that 35% retail sales tax isn't paid. So I understand the attraction of a retail sales tax. In some ways, it seems a lot easier than an income tax. But when you get down to looking at the details, I'm quite worried that we could raise the revenue we need in a fair and cost-effective way.
Yeah, but people have a lot more money because instead of, let's say, they make $500 a week and without taxes taken off, well, that's what they'll have to begin with.
Oh, that's true. We can tax you when you earn it or tax you when you spend it. Your take-home pay would be higher, but then, of course, you'd face that levy at the end. I'm not saying that a retail sales tax would take a lot more money from you. It would just take it at a different stage. I just want people to understand what kind of rate we're talking about, in case they think it would be, you know, a lot less burdensome than the income tax.
But talking about cheaters, you're always going to have cheaters, no matter what. We got cheaters with the system we got now. There's always people, you know, cheating on their income tax.
Yes,
so.
I agree with that.
So, I mean, you're always going to have that.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Thanks.
All right, very good. Thank you for the call. We'll continue. The next is, let me see here. I think it would be Champagne, and that's line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was just wondering if you could define for me what you consider taxes. I have a feeling that you're not comparing all the income-based revenue that the federal government takes in when you compare your numbers for different ranges of incomes.
Is there some particular tax you have in mind that you don't think we're considering?
I was wondering how you consider the employer donated FICA contribution.
Yeah, in these numbers that I've been citing, that is included. It includes. You know, when I talk about all federal taxes, when, for instance, before I said the top 1% pays 29% of their income in taxes in 2000, that includes all federal taxes. So it's got the income tax, both employer and employee, Social Security tax, it's got federal excise taxes, it's got the estate tax, the corporate income tax, all of those things.
And, unemployment tax every little ding and twist that gets paid that is income-based?
Yeah, and not just income-based, everything. I mean, taxes on cigarettes and gas and things like that are in there as well. They, the Treasury Department tried to estimate who pays those taxes as well.
So they've basically given you numbers that they estimate that this tax came from, or that 30% of it came from the top 1%.
Yeah, or rather that the top 1% paid 30% of their income in all the various taxes that the federal government levies.
Right. I see. So this is not just a discussion on income tax per se.
Right. It includes all federal taxes.
It's all means and methods by which the federal government takes money from us.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm glad to understand that. It was not readily apparent.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Let's go on to Peru, Illinois. This would be line number three. Hello.
Yes, I had, along the same lines, was wondering about the Social Security tax and also the fact that part of it is hidden from Social Security and used in the general fund either as non-tax interest. And how does that affect the income tax?
It's true that now for most Americans, Social Security payroll taxes are bigger than income tax, if you include both the part that the employer and the employee part. Most of our book is about the income tax and the estate tax. The problem with looking at the payroll taxes is that they're very tied up with our Social Security system. So my own view is that if we're going to think of changing how the payroll taxes work, we should do that in the context of a evaluation of the whole Social Security system. And we started a national debate about that in terms of the Bush privatization proposals a couple of years ago, but it didn't get very far. There's a difference between those taxes and income tax in that the payroll taxes are tied in some way to the benefits you get when you're retired, and that's different than income taxes, which are not tied to any particular service or payment you get from the government. So I like to keep the debate about the Social Security and Medicare payroll taxes separate from the income tax, because I want to talk about the former in the context of the bigger system.
Does that get at your question, caller?
Well, that seems to be everybody likes to keep that separate, but yet when it comes to spending the money, the trust fund isn't kept separate from the general fund.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. That's an important issue. I mean, that's not really the focus of our book or our talk today, but it is true that Social Security system by itself is bringing in more revenue than it's paying out in benefits right now. And the purpose of that was to help prepare for this huge number of elderly people in the future. The idea was we would raise the Social Security tax to help reduce overall budget deficits for the federal government, and which would effectively help us save more and prepare for this future need. And there's a lot of debate over whether that actually worked. Some people think that, you know, this tax increase in Social Security merely led the government to spend more or to cut other taxes. And it's really hard to answer that question, whether that's true or not. I mean, it may be that our budget deficits would have ended up being even bigger without this tax increase. So it's, you know, we'd really need two United States, one where we tried to build up this Social Security Trust Fund and one where we didn't, and see how things turned out differently in each United States. So it's not obvious whether, you know, this trust fund helped or not.
We're at the point where, I'm very sorry to say, we're going to have to stop. There are many things we could talk about, including one angle that you do deal with the book, and that is the relationship between taxes and the economy. But we can't do that. If people are interested, again, you should look at the book that we mentioned. It's titled Taxing Ourselves, A Citizen's Guide to the Debate Over Taxes. It is published by the MIT Press by our two guests here. John Bhatia, he is Associate Professor of Economics at Williams College in Williamstown, Massachusetts. To you, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Joel Slemrod, he's an economist at the University of Michigan, where he's also director of tax policy research there at the university. And Joel, thank you very much.
Well, thanks for having me, Dan.
And perhaps sometime we can talk again and get at some of the issues that we didn't touch on.
Very good.
Great. Thank you.